the other researcher who I thought I bought her book is Carol Graham. If you're curious about intercultural differences in happiness and want to see another book, I must have bought it for the library, but I'll send that around. Okay, I want to draw you guys into this. We do have a chance for, I think we have a good opportunity for a small group discussion, maybe two. I want to do, maybe try one real quick on this table. If you have, let's start with Diener and Sue, if you have that handy. And so Diener and Sue is a long article. It's got this fairly complicated measurement section. This is about as in-depth as we're going to get in measurement issues. Diener is one of the real fastidious measurement experts in happiness studies. I mean, so he often weighs in on people's research critically or praising it for its statistics and measurement issues. So he's really into that. So you get these 3 points on measurement, right? So let's start setting up your notes a little bit. And then we get to really maybe the more exciting stuff, which is how do we look at differences across nations in happiness, and how do we look at differences across ethnicities in happiness? When I first started doing intercultural, well, we'll get to that story later. So before we get to the measurement issues, I just want to see if you guys have anything interesting to. We'll put you in. So our method point today is that. Sorry, let's get. So, you know, so far in the course, we've really been talking more about getting happier, you know, although some of our comparisons, like our fictional comparisons of Bob and Pat and Lee and Bob and Mary, and have been qualitative, but we've often referenced them in terms of the quantitative research, you know, who's happier. But today we kind of get into qualitative differences more. And so put in your notes this way. Is the goal of a happiness theory to make you happier or help you figure out which kind of happiness you ought to pursue? Obviously, that's not an either or, right? You can put an and in there if you want. I mean, you might. Some things in your theory will be focused on things you've learned in the course that you think are helpful in understanding how to make yourself happier. Some things in your theory will be things you learned in the course about discerning the kinds of happiness that are appropriate for you. And that's going to vary by person. So that's, another reason why I want you to be thinking about my theory of happiness, not a theory of happiness for everybody in the world. Okay. So when we bring in culture, we start to get these qualitative differences in mind. Okay. So what I'd like you to do, if you could, even without getting too far into the article, you may have noticed this chart on page 436. So one of the more impressive data sets in international happiness studies comes out of the World Values Surveys, and it's a huge longitudinal data set that covers that's been applied around the world. You can research it if you want. There are also local or regional happiness instruments which attempt to track cultural differences. So there's an Afrobarometer of happiness. But this has the advantage of being globally comparative, but put it in your notes this way, it has the potential disadvantage of not registering important differences in types of happiness, right? So this is just a way of trying to compare happiness by country in terms of life satisfaction, right? So remember our little shortcut here. Life satisfaction in that first column, and then hedonic balance, which is going to be a balance of positive and negative affect. I assume they just took, isn't it just negative affect over positive affect? Is that right? Or the other way around? No, it's not just a simple division, is it? Okay, I'm not sure how hedonic balance is treated. So here's what I thought was interesting, and I want to kind of see if you want to get into if you have anything in groups to come out of groups with this. Notice how big a variance you get, right? Can we just take a look at that together? You know, just on the screen. So the countries that tend to rank happiest in the world surveys year after year are the Northern European countries. And notice the huge ratio between positive affect and negative affect. Maybe some of you have some travel experiences. The first time I went to Copenhagen, I was just disgusted by how happy everybody was. I mean, the positive affect. I mean, it's just amazing. This woman, I was buying a bagel from this woman, and she was just beaming at me. You know, I felt like telling her, you know, have you heard about the Capilano Bridge study? You know, guys can get easily confused if people are too nice to them. So, you know, it's just incredibly happy, like people serving you coffee are just going to give you this really genuine positive smile. Have any of you experienced that? Any of you traveled in Northern European countries? There's angry, nasty people there, don't get me wrong. But there's a kind of general, this data kind of fits. So when I look at this, I kind of say, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. I guess that sort of captures something about my phenomenal experience of at least we've been to two of those countries. And then when I look at Italy, which I have a little more experience with, I see a similarly high positive affect to low to negative affect ratio. And one of the things you read about Italians in happiness literature is that they value pleasantness for their positive affect. So the qualitative dimension of their positive affect isn't sort of like the Copenhagen bagel salesperson. It's more like, it's not a beaming, joyous smile. It's more like a pleasant smile. It's kind of like, you know, so what's your base? So the point for your notes is, in your experience, how do different ethnicities and different nationalities model affect? Let's keep it simple. And for your reference point here, think about countries you've visited, but if you haven't traveled as much, think about ethnicities within your own experience. Some of you can give first-person accounts of how Italians, for instance, like their kids to get all excited all the time. So they tend to make their kids really rambunctious and excited. So child-rearing styles come into play here. But what I'd like you to do quickly in small groups, if it makes sense, is see if this data correlates with your phenomenal awareness, that is, your qualitative awareness, to the extent that some of you have traveled or have experience with your own ethnicity or differences, comparisons, as you grew up with other people from other countries, other ethnicities. Can you read from the numbers? Can you say, oh, yeah, that's kind of what Italian happiness looks like from my experience? Tends to be low negative affect. Italians place a high value on suppressing negative affect, but they place a value on positive affect as pleasantness. So that would be my way of connecting with that data. So could you just quickly get into groups and see if your experience base gives you any way of connecting with these numbers? Okay, I just want to kind of start with that. Just for a few minutes, not a long exercise. Okay, so just tell me if this worked. Was there any correlation between numbers and your experience of nationalities or ethnicities? Did we get anything from this? I was trying to suggest that in my experience I had three examples for you. I didn't give you the third one. Yeah, please go.
So I lived in Spain for a year, and just from what I noticed, like outside of the home, inside of the home, you hear a bunch of stuff,
right,
about what the protests are about, and like how unhappy people are and stuff like that. But then you go out into like the city, and everyone's pretty jolly. People are doing pretty fun things. I mean, you have siesta, people are partying,
right,
like late night stuff like that. You go into a shop, and the person like taking your order and doing whatever is pretty jolly, and they just have a lot of good things. But you know, you leave the store, and there's right. Like thousands of people.
Right.
So I think I noticed that difference because their life satisfaction was pretty high up on the board.
Right.
But
on that. Okay, good.
But their hedonic.
Yeah, you're describing a social life that has a high tolerance for positive and negative affect, which is kind of what you saw on the numbers for Spain. Latin cultures tend to be like that. Italian culture is a little different. It is a Latin culture, but it has kind of a relatively low negative affect number. But let me ask you this. If you were to go to downtown Spokane on a Friday night and look at the scene and how people were having fun, would you feel a difference? Would you be able to notice that as an American scene versus a Spanish scene of people downtown having fun? Right, so that's what we're getting at, is the textural difference, the qualitative differences. Any other travelers in the room? Yeah.
The people with the highest life satisfaction were Switzerland, but yeah. their positive affect number wasn't very high, but their negative affect number was like a third of the
right.
next smallest.
Right, right.
Well, and I definitely feel like I noticed that because Swiss people don't really seem ridiculously jovial all
yeah.
the time, but they
yeah.
also don't, like, nothing is bad in Switzerland, it feels like. Like, everything is in the
yeah.
right place
that's right.
at the right time.
What?
They're not under threat of war.
No, that's right. culture's happiness kind of reflects their existential situation. So, yeah, you're picking up on this. You're reminding me of this Swiss couple I saw again this summer, and that fits them, too. Yeah. As opposed to the Swedes, the Swedes are just ridiculous. Just totally high positive affect and fairly, really muted. I mean, they're not down there like the Swiss, but they've been fairly muted negative affect. I just envy them, like, oh, get out, you know. Others? Good. Other travelers? Other people who make comparisons within this country with ethnic cultures? We're going to get into some of the details later in the article about cultures, the way cultures model affect. Anything else? Yeah. Okay, good. Well, the third example I had, and it'll really come up later in the article, is that individualistic cultures tend to have both high positive peak and high negative peak. I guess the point I was trying to make with this is that there is some connection. These numbers seem to have some validity because there's some connection between our stereotypes or experiences with people in these cultures and what we're seeing here. Okay, let me just say a little bit about the measurement issues. I don't want to get into too much technical here, but just see, we've actually said a lot of this already, so I don't think I need to. He uses the technical term artifacts as a distorting thing in surveys. You maybe should take a note on that. An artifact is when a survey is distorted by an artifact, it's a problem. And artifacts can be things like different ways that you administer a survey, giving the survey on a sunny day versus a cloudy day, maybe people's judgments about their happiness. This was a hypothesis that was tested in the literature for a while. I think we got an answer now. Maybe people are really influenced in how they fill out the survey by what kind of day they're having. So maybe even life satisfaction, right, which should be a long-term judgment about how your life is going, maybe even that's thrown off if you're having a lousy day. Well, you know, there's what I remember the research on this is that those are not big effects. A lot of those effects come out in large numbers. Remember from last class about the law of large numbers. So, but artifacts can be a problem. So Diener, being a good measurement person, is worried about that. So here are some ways that some of these measurement issues we've seen before. Wealth, we talked about last time, is clustered with other factors like rights, equality, fulfillment needs, fulfillment needs, and individualism. We've also seen before this phenomenon that people's happiness across nations doesn't track objective conditions. So the point is that everybody kind of reports themselves to be relatively happy, and that suggests a kind of group relative judgment, or that we kind of set a baseline. So that our judgments about our own happiness aren't absolute judgments. Like, how happy am I compared to everybody else in the world? That's not how... So the point for your notes would be that's probably not how we make happiness judgments. We probably ask, how happy am I relative to people in my society? Right?
We've talked before about multiple measures as a way of confirming self-reports. So he mentions that. So we don't really need to spend too much time on some of these details. And I thought, maybe you guys have a thought about this. The detail on 437 about Russian and U.S. students always kind of catches my attention. Do you think that some... So the detail is that Russian students report much lower levels of well-being than U.S. college students, I think it was the comparison. And they scored lower on event memory measure of subjective well-being. So there's two kinds of memory measures here I want you to track. One is event memory, which is just about the ability to recall as many positive memories as they can. And then negative, and then to recall negative. Event memory is just recall of positive and negative events. Then there's a second phenomena called negative memory bias. And that's a bias toward recalling negative events. So the Russians could have, let's see if I got it right here. Yeah, the Russians have a negative event bias because they recall relatively fewer pleasing events. So that's something to think about for yourself. Do you have I have a radical positive memory bias. So when my family when I talk, you know, I'll be with my family and they'll say, "Oh, you know, that was a great vacation we did, you know, back in the day," and I say, "Yeah, but you don't remember like the car broke down?" And, "Oh, really? Did it? Was that vacation?" I mean, that's how bad my memory is. But so the puzzle is that you can have a bad memory in the sense that you don't remember negative events very well. They're harder for you to recall. Or you can have a memory that's biased toward negative memories. Do any of you think you have a relatively positive or negative memory bias? Sometimes you see it, you might not want to say. Sometimes you see it in... How many of you see it in your friends? How many of you have friends who you know characteristically will talk about predominantly negative things? Yeah. You have friends like that?
Yeah.
They can be a lot of fun to be with still, right?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily judgment about them. Right? Others? How many of you have friends who are like me about my memory? They tend to always pick out the positive things. So think about those biases, because those are things that could be habitual. I mean, one of our models for intercultural differences is that they're the result of social learning. And so we're at an interesting point in the course because we're going to start to look at other literature next week, in a very different kind of literature. So the point for your notes is, first point, a lot of cultural differences and national differences. The deep hypothesis is that they're the result of social learning. That is, social learning is communicated through a society and passed on to new members, right? So we would expect that people joining Swiss society would eventually, let's say a Syrian refugee is coming into Sweden or Switzerland as a refugee, we would expect their affect profile to start to approximate the culture that they're assimilating to. And we might expect it would be great if you guys found research on this, we might expect it to approximate that culture to the extent that they assimilate, right? So if you're going to stay in an ethnic enclave of just people from Syria, you might expect them to sustain the... Everybody with me? Okay. So that's kind of the model. So the first point for your notes is that social learning might explain cultural differences in happiness. The second point for your notes is more relevant to you. What aspects of my social learning should I unlearn? After all, social learning suggests that your bias toward an approach of expressing affect from your culture, maybe that's working for you, but maybe you want to unlearn some of those socially acquired expectations about how to express positive and negative affect. How, put it in your notes, raise this question for yourself. How flexible is my hedonic balance? If it's a product of social learning, does that mean I'm stuck with it? I'm always going to have the hedonic balance of an American?
one of the things I valued about having gone to Italy a lot, often to teach for Gonzaga, is that I started to realize, it took me a long time, embarrassingly long time, that people kind of treated me different in Italy. You know, I mentioned the thing about social status and professors, so I kind of noticed that right away. But I kind of noticed that, I don't know how to put this, you know, I just didn't feel as odd there. I didn't realize I looked odd here, but, you know, because I'm an American, I grew up here, I feel very much like an American. But Italians started to treat me a little more like an Italian, even though, like, I'm an American. So sometimes they'd come up to me and speak to me in Italian before I knew much Italian, and I'd be like, oh my God. And then I started to realize that, well, I don't want to get too far into it, but the thing is, you can go to a culture and feel, whether it's your culture of origin or not. I mean, my grandparents are Sicilian, they're not exactly Italian. That's a whole different story. But you can go to a culture, and how many of you have this experience? Say, wow, I kind of like what they're doing here, happiness-wise. Yeah, I'm getting some nods. Any examples? My example is Italian culture. Feeling, being recognized as an Italian in a culture experience I never had. I didn't start traveling until I was a professor. So you know, that was a real interesting experience, because I was noticing that I wanted to model the affect profile of Italians more than my home culture. And then I'd come back to the U.S. and I'd become an American again. It took, you know, days to weeks. And then I'd go travel again, and I'd be like, oh, this is great. And the food's better. So any examples? I got some nods here. Any examples for that? Something that you liked in a culture you visited related to its texture of happiness or quality of happiness. Evan mentioned, you know, the way people could tolerate a protest and still be pretty happy about, you know, serving you dinner or whatever it was, right? Yeah. Did you have one?
Well, we've talked about it before in here, just how food and meals, anything,
good,
are such a social
good
aspect,
good,
of their culture in Italy.
Good.
Actually, and I
good
really enjoyed that. And it's really, I mean, even sitting out in a cafe,
right,
talking over a cappuccino,
right,
or even having a long discussion over dinner.
Right.
Meals were like an hour and a half minimum.
Right.
Or 2 hours.
And they had a different feeling to them. I mean, it's not like you don't have fun going to Starbucks here or going to Red Robin or wherever you go. God forbid you go to Red Robin, but you know, but yeah, that's a good example. The hedonic texture of a meal is highly specific to a culture, and when you come back from, when a lot of students come back from traveling, wherever they go, they often come back with negative comments about how we serve meals here. Yeah, I don't know if you feel that way, but, you know. Okay, other examples? Yeah, I got a bunch of nods on this before.
I went to Ireland when I was abroad, and
yeah,
just, like, their going out culture is a lot different. It's, like, all ages, live music. It's not
good,
just, like, getting dressed up.
Yeah.
It was different.
It was
what
yeah
I've seen.
I've noticed that in Italy as well. Intergenerational celebration.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something we don't do. We have a highly age-segregated approach to celebration here. So start to think about that in your culture. I'm sure we could talk about other examples. So the other two method issues are, one, this is a really interesting one. It gets very technical. I'll just give you a quick gloss on it. How do we know that, so happiness isn't just, happiness is a constellation of words. How do we know that when we ask somebody about their happiness in Benin, Africa, versus Indonesia, how do we know that they experience the same semantic cluster of words around happiness in the same way? So think about that. Maybe find a way to represent that in your notes. If happiness involves a bunch of meanings, a bunch of words in relation to each other, how do we know that they're in the same relationship across cultures? And that's a measurement issue, right? I'm sorry, this is number three. I'm jumping around a little bit. I'll come back to two. What if the terms used in happiness surveys have different weights or relationships with each other and with happiness in different cultures? And so he gets into that, and the short answer is there is some evidence of scale and variance. That would be the answer you're looking for. No, it's roughly the same. And remember, this gets us back to Gilbert, who's asking a slightly different question about language. Remember with Reba and Lori, how do we know if they're using the words differently and having the same experience or a different experience?
Right.
The second measurement issue was, and I used to be so surprised by this, the first few years I was reading this literature, why nations? Why not ethnicities? Was anybody else puzzled by that? If we're going to look at cultural differences, why are we comparing Canada and the U.S. versus German Americans and Polish Americans? I eventually got an answer. Maybe I'll just give it to you, see if it resonates with you. I think the answer is that we look to our society. Our society is, putting it this way, our society is the social comparison group more so than our ethnicity. We look to our governments and society to provide goods and opportunities, so that's our comparison. That's the best answer I can find. The research suggests bluntly that it's nations that predict it's nation membership that predicts happiness. So that's the short answer, is that one's a better predictor than the other. So I can find out more about your hedonic balance by asking what country you live in than asking what ethnicity you have. But ethnicities have distinct patterns of hedonic balance. So it's just one's more predictive than the other. That's, as far as I can tell from the research, that's why. So nations are meaningful units of analysis. It doesn't mean that ethnicities aren't. It's just that nations predict better. Okay, let's get into the actual results, because I think that's kind of the most interesting stuff. So one result is rich nations are happier than poor nations. And we know that, but we also know that there's cluster effects. So we have the answer is we haven't really sorted those out. It's hard to know how much democracy, one of you found an interesting piece on democracy and happiness. It's hard to know how much democracy boosts happiness because democratic cultures tend to be rich cultures. So it's hard to isolate those effects. Individualism, I think, is a big area. I do think we have an interesting opportunity for small group discussions. So let me set that up with you. This is probably, this is probably the single biggest variable that we have data on. Individualistic cultures have higher subjective well-being but higher suicide rates. That's us. Collectivist cultures might be working with a different model of happiness. So Carol Graham, I mentioned Happiness Around the World, that she's still one of the big researchers, but I think this Eric Weiner book is pretty good. He's a good reporter. But it's hard to say, is individualism what makes people happy, or is it that individualistic cultures tend to be wealthy cultures, they tend to protect rights, they tend to be democratic? Here's an interesting detail. Happiness is more salient to individualists. In other words, people in individualistic cultures think about their happiness more than people in collectivist cultures. So that kind of got me thinking this morning, maybe that means that comparing individualistic models of happiness and collectivist models isn't apples to apples, right? Maybe there's a kind of, you've got your thumb on the scale, because, you know, if you ask an individualist about their happiness, that's what they've been thinking about. You see what I mean? So is it a fair comparison? So the thing I want you to think about in your small group and see if you can come up with any reasoning about is, go back to this section. This is just this section on individualism. It just starts, it's not that long. It starts on 441. There's some detail that you should rehearse this detail in your group. Even if only one person has the article, you'd remind everybody what's in there. Read through that first couple of paragraphs. Even down through that column, the first column on 442. And then try to ask yourself this question. When we compare individualist and collectivist cultures on happiness, are we looking at two different models of happiness? So if we saw a lower hedonic balance from a collectivist culture, would that tell us that they were less happy? Or would that just tell us that people in collectivist cultures just don't think about their happiness so much? And then second level of questions, which I didn't get up here, do you find the attractions of individualistic happiness culture comfortable, irresistible? Do you find do you wonder if there could be good things about collectivist models of happiness? Have you had any exposure to people who are operating with more of a collectivist model of happiness? After all, we're the culture that's most heavily invested, probably in the world, in individualism as a cultural value. It's got a lot to recommend itself. Suicide rates aren't the most best-selling point, right? So what I mean, I'd like you to start by thinking about this difference between individualism and collectivism. Are they comparative? And then try to get into some of the differences. Are there things about your individualistic culture that you might want to call into questions or ask questions about? How does it look to you? Okay, so give that two to five minutes maybe, take this question first and then try to ask the second question. Okay. I'll put the second one on the board. We've just a few minutes on this, guys.
I'd rather be happy somewhere, like, fresh every time, and be, like, all
Couple more minutes. Okay, gang, let's see what you got on this.
It's kind of an abstract comparison, but I'm counting on some of you having experiences that help give you information about this, or just being able to reflect on this. So for the first kind of question, do you think it's a different kind of happiness? Or do you think it's... Are they comparative? Can we compare American culture with Myanmar? What do you think? Is it apples and oranges? I mean, it seems like comparing Italy and France is different than comparing, I mean, right? What do you guys think?
It's sort of like asking, while you guys were working, I was asking myself, would I be happy in a collectivist culture? I don't know. That would be one way of getting at how different it is. You could say, well, I'd be less happy. No, I would be unhappy. See, that would be more the qualitative difference. Any thoughts on that? Yeah, please. So.
I don't know if this makes sense, but maybe if you're in a collectivist culture, you're thinking about, am I happy? Would it matter as much to you? So
yeah.
Maybe it isn't a good comparison because you'd be more focused on, is my...
Right.
Are my grandparents happier? You are much more dispersed with how you feel about your family in regards to thinking about your needs versus their needs.
That was one of the things I was wondering. You could accuse individualistic cultures of being self-absorbed. Would I experience it as a liberation if I could just spend less time thinking about my happiness? Because arguably, we members of individualistic cultures, to the extent that you see yourself that way, apparently we spend a lot of time thinking about that.
I think you'd be still thinking about it, but it wouldn't be yourself.
Right.
It would
right.
be the happiness, and I feel that could almost be more worrisome.
Yeah,
because
maybe.
More
right.
Over yourself than
right.
you do of others.
Right. Yeah, because you're entangled with all these people. I have Italian friends who live in intergenerational households, grandma, grandpa, down to the kids, three generations, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe you guys don't have to do this. I just wish I didn't feel obligated to do this. It's just so complicated to come home to three generations, I mean, it's hard enough for American couples to just deal with one or two kids.
Another aspect. Is perhaps in an individualistic culture, there's more of a sense of am I happier than the people around me, in that, because there's a man is as happy, the happiest man on earth is one who makes more money than his wife's sister's husband.
Right, right.
So comparative happiness is more important in an individualistic American culture.
Yeah. Would you experience that as a liberation? Maybe I would, you know. Sometimes when I do this, I may have mentioned this to some of you, that I woof in the summer. I go work on a farm, on an organic farm for a couple of weeks, and sometimes for more than a couple of weeks. And when you're on this farm, your social comparison just kind of falls away. You've got this group of people you're working with, and that's it, you know. And so would I experience, sometimes I experience that as a liberation, you know. Would there be something, when I think about collectivist culture and my personality, having grown up in this culture, I think, God, this would be really oppressive to be told that you should just get a job here because your family's here. I mean, we're one hallmark of individualistic cultures. We move around like crazy in this country. But that also means that we separate ourselves from relationships that we're going to study later in the course. There's a lot of good data that whether you live in one culture or another, relationships matter a lot. So what is the effect in our culture of maximizing our personal well-being through our careers by being ready to move anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world? That's an individualist. But what is the effect of that on relationships, right? I sometimes envy my friends who kind of stayed in the cities of their extended family. Sometimes I hear about you guys making decisions, conscious decisions, to kind of stay near your family. How many of you would put a priority on that, for example? No, not sure. Not sure you want to say? Yeah, some of you would. Not sure how it's going to turn out, right? But, you know, that's in the mix, right? Like maybe I'll stay near my family. Maybe I'll stay in the Northwest, because I like, you know, maybe you can like the Northwest. Okay. Anything else on this? Yeah, please.
I'm just thinking, like, because we see individuals to cultures a lot of times, like, chasing happiness, but I feel like you could also look at it as, like, running away from unhappiness. Like, the fear that you would be unhappy if you don't do certain things. And I think collectivist cultures don't have that fear as much.
That's interesting.
They don't try to run to happiness, but they also don't try to run away from happiness.
I like that contrast.
Everyone's kind of in it together.
Yeah, you don't really... I can see how in a collectivist culture there's kind of a model for your happiness. You don't... You don't have the... We're going to see this in the history of happiness later in the term. You don't have this American anxiety about how you're doing. Because because in the collectivist model, you've got a role. You're a daughter, a son. You're a mom or a dad. You're in this... maybe not family structure, but also social structure. You have these duties in the community, and you get your happiness from that more. Okay. That's a huge cross-cultural... axis, and a lot of research is on that. If you want to pursue that more, that you'll find interesting stuff. Okay, I think we should. These are really interesting theories. At the end, you should definitely have a sense of how people are kind of modeling this. I don't want to spend our time on that now. I want to kind of transition to Gilbert now, which is really a different topic, but kind of connected in a way. Like I said, the theme today is. Not just happier, but happy, different, qualitative difference in happiness. So let's take a look at the Gilbert article, because it gets us into some really neat contemporary psychology, and the philosophy majors will note that we get to talk about Immanuel Kant, which is great. How exciting. So, and majors and minors, we have a bunch. So here's what we're doing, right? At the beginning, we get this contrast between Adolf Fischer and George Eastman. You learn that Adolf Fischer... Anybody want to do this for me? You have this at the tip of your tongue, please. Yeah. Adolf Fischer is this guy who got... an activist who got caught up in the Haymarket riots, falsely accused and hung. And before he's hung, he says, "The happiest day of my life." Eastman is Kodak Eastman, right? Incredibly successful business person, very creative, you know, behind all these innovations. Kodak's gone down the tubes now, but, you know, kills himself. And the short point for your notes is that's counterintuitive. First word you need. It's counterintuitive that Eastman would be less happy. We would think Eastman would be happier. Second point, you need to know the narrative. If you don't know the narrative, you can't understand this. And so he's going to take us into some psychology about just what some of the distinctive things about our minds. We're still talking about the brain, by the way, but we're not talking about neurons anymore. We're talking about this incredible thing that human minds do in a very particular way. And he starts to describe it this way. He says, let me get, let's see, a couple of steps here, sorry. the first thing you need are these early results about how we reweave experience. Now, you've already gotten some data on how bad we are at comparing our experiences, or about how bad we are at being aware of everything in our experience, like the Dora study, where the person is replaced and the subject doesn't notice it. But this is more about how, put it in your notes this way, events after an experience change the memory of the experience. Wow. That's disturbing. Events after an experience can change the memory of an experience, positively or negatively, so don't give up yet. I mean, so the car and stop sign yield study, can we just do that together? Maybe one of you want to try and take that on. It's a little complicated. It would have been a great quiz question. Page 79. Somebody want to try that? This is a study in which yeah, so they watch a video of a car coming up to a yield sign, turning and hitting a pedestrian. And then some test subjects are asked.
They asked, did you see the other car that stopped at the stop sign? And then they thought there was a stop sign.
Right. And then and it's not a huge effect. I mean, it turns out that the test subjects that weren't asked remember that it picked the... So then they're shown stop sign picture, yield sign picture. And the point is that the people who were given the false information about stop sign in the question were less likely to pick out the picture accurately. So they tended to pick out the stop sign picture more often. They were still 80% correct, and the people who didn't get asked were 90% correct. So it's not a huge difference, but it is a difference. So the point is that by being asked incorrectly about the event, the test subjects rewove their experience and remembered the event as involving a stop sign. Has everybody got that? So it's an illustration of, that's why it illustrates what he wants. And this is a generally confirmed result. Memory fills things in, and this is important for your notes. Memory fills things in, and we don't notice it happening. So you have that word list exercise where, you know, you can guess that gasoline was on the list, but sleep, you wouldn't have guessed. You wouldn't, because so many of the words had to do with sleep. He had a couple of examples of that, actually. So one way to look at this is that we have literal and metaphorical blind spots. He goes through the whole blind spot thing. But the more important point really is that... let me erase some space. The more important general point, let's put it in your notes this way, is that our minds are not video recorders, right? That we said that last time with the other research, and it's true of this research too. Our minds are not video recorders. We just don't have the space for that. It wouldn't be efficient, you know, it wouldn't serve our evolved interests. So we have very selective attention. But one thing we can do that's really remarkable is we can read each other's minds. And this is in the research literature, this is called theory of mind. Theory of mind is our capacity, which we gain somewhere around ages 3 to 4, to look at the world through the minds of other people. Who do you know that one? Look at the world through the minds of other people. And the quickest way to show you this is by showing you a little video about the false belief test. How many of you have learned about the false belief test? Oh, good. Well, probably in a few years everybody will know about it, so I at least have something to share with you then. So let's look at that, and then I'm going to come back and pick up some more details from the chapter, okay?
Mail address compromised?
Whoops.
Find out with a free dark web email scan.
Discovered that however smart your 3-year-old is, she doesn't seem able to put herself in someone else's mental shoes to imagine how they think and what they believe. Perhaps you thought your parenting skills were to blame. but scientists suggest that understanding other minds is a skill that may not be fully developed until a child is about 4. To learn how children's social skills evolve between about 3 and 4, researchers use something called a false belief test. What do you think's in this box? Looks fairly obvious, doesn't it? Crayons. But let me show you. I filled it full of candles. Right? Now I close it up again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've been having this conversation.
I should have said this at the beginning. In this video, you also meet one of the most famous child psychologists in the world, Alison Gopnik. She's amazing. You should read her books. You also meet the last person in the world who owns a turtleneck shirt, which is this guy here.
Sophie's been down here, asleep, doesn't know what we've talked about. But let's bring him into the conversation. Now I have another question for you. What do you think Snoopy will say if I ask him what's in this box? Crayons, obviously. What else could anybody possibly say?
See, but here's the more complicated side for your notes. It's also the moment at which we become very susceptible to other people's perspectives. We become aware that we're in a world that people see in very different ways, and we start to get pulled by those competing interpretations of the world that people have. And then eventually you get to middle school, and it's just horrible. you see where I'm going? I mean, you get to this point where you become increasingly susceptible to anxiety about how you should act and behave vis-a-vis all these other minds that you know about. And as you get to be that, you know, middle school years, your brain's getting bigger and more sophisticated, and you're tracking all these complex social differences. So the point for your notes is that social learning is part of this capacity that we have, and it's a double-edged sword. Social learning is how we learn how to imitate good behaviors and incorporate them into our life, how we interject our culture's values and embody them. But social learning can also limit the way we see the world and limit our sense of what happiness is, because we could be conditioned by it and the pressure of other minds. So becoming sensitive to other minds is a double-edged sword, right? It's so beautiful. It's what allows us to live in a human social world. But it poses some very obvious problems for happiness, because it suggests that we could have learned things in our family life, in our social life, in our culture, in our ethnicity, that may not help our happiness. Okay. That's kind of the main point for both that theory of mind and this chapter. Let's see if I can just make this contrast really clear for you. So the contrast again is between a philosopher like John Locke, who basically thought, like an empiricist, that objects were coming in and we were recording them in our brain, and the model of mind that comes in with Kant, which has held up much better for research like the false belief test, which basically says that we're not just taking the world in, we're actively constructing it. We're taking things in, of course. We're not making it up out of whole cloth, but our experience, and you know, think about all the Gilbert research, all the research Gilbert's been citing about how spotty our experience is and so on. We're producing a consciousness of the world partly from the way our minds are structured and possibly from the way our minds are conditioned. So the challenge for happiness is what capacity do I have to question and break out of some of those interpretations, some of those cultural pressures? Did you have something else? No. So once you start to see the world through this, through theory of mind, through Kantian idealism, which is getting at the same idea that the world is not recorded for us, it is constructed by us, and it's a social world. Once you get to this point, you can see how the happiness problem is much more complicated. I now have to ask myself, which of the socially learned behaviors, attitudes, and values that I've acquired are working for me, are good for me? Which of them are strengths in my happiness, and which of them are holding me back? I mean, maybe I want to enjoy a Friday night like they enjoy in Spain. Maybe I want to have something more of the texture of that happiness in my life. Can I do that if I'm living in a Red Robin culture? I don't know. What would it be like to construct the terms of your happiness according to your own critical thoughts rather than just saying, well, this is kind of, I'm an American, so this is what I'm going to do. So that's, I think that's an intensely interesting question. I should have already done the truck study, but maybe we can just work that in real quick before we break. Anybody remember the truck study? Let's set it up. It's on, maybe it helps to see the picture. So this is a, yeah, please, start us out.
I was just going to say, isn't it where you're like looking at, there's like a small truck and then a smaller truck and you're looking at one of the small trucks, but that's actually a medium truck or something about your like failing to look from the eyes of the person who's asking you.
Right. So this is a study in which test subjects are asked to hand a director a truck based on the director's question, right? Anybody want to do the next step?
The director sees two trucks, which are the large and medium truck, and then the subject sees three, the large, medium, and small trucks. So the subject is then asked to hand the smallest truck to the director of the test, and at first they reach for the small truck and then realize that the medium truck is the small truck in the eyes of the director of the test and hand that truck to the director.
Right. So this study is very good. This study shows how we switch from an absolute reference point to a relative reference point, relative to the director's field of vision. Because you can see, as a test subject, you can see which cubby holes go through. Are you with me? Which cubby holes go through, so which the director can see. And when you have a little eye movement machine hooked up to the test, you know, to watch the test subject, you see them make the eye movements as realists, so the absolute is the realist, that's the Lockean, and the relative is the Kantian. It's the person who has theory of mind. And that's what I meant by mind reading. You know, what we do routinely is we read each other's minds. It's a really remarkable thing. We spend the rest of the day just being amazed at it. And do it, you know. You'll be reading each other's minds even to get out of the room. Otherwise, you'd bump into each other, right? So again, just to remind, yeah, did everybody get the point of the study? So we have these two perspectives. We work with them, in you know, fluidly, and the eye movement thing catches that. Again, just to recap the point, and then we'll break. This capacity we have to read each other's minds, to live in a world where we are aware that every mind has a slightly different interpretation, it's an amazing capacity. It's connected to social learning. It could be one of the. It gives us some tremendous ways of being happy because we can enter into other people's minds. We aren't just amusing ourselves. But it raises some potential dangers for happiness because at the cultural level, social learning could limit the qualitative forms of our happiness, and we sometimes learn that as young adults by traveling. And seeing that there are, or by having friends who are different than us, and seeing that we don't all approach the problem of happiness the same way. We don't all approach affect the same way. And so it raises a really interesting critical problem that I hope will be, you know, live for you in the course, which is how do I know when social learning is good? I'm just going to repeat what I said before. How do I know when social learning and living with other minds is working for me, and when it's constraining or imposing pressures that might limit my happiness. Okay, let's stop there. I'll see you guys on Thursday.